Hello and welcome to Journey of the Monkey King with myself, Quiva, and my friend MJ.
Hello!
So we're on to chapter 32. Sun Wukong has been reunited with the pilgrims. Before we continue, this episode is going to feature more mentions of cannibalism and more threats of beatings, the kind of standard fare at this point.
But on the plus side, we're done with child murder.
Yes.
I have been assured that we are done. Are we done, like, completely with child murder or just for this episode? We are done with child murder! And I don't want to know, so let's keep going. I don't live alone. All my housemates have just heard me shout very loudly, we are done with child murder. So that's going to be a fun thing to explain to people.
My we're done with child murder t-shirt is raising a lot of questions that are answered by the t-shirts.
Who's that lovely person who keeps asking if we do merch, and can you weigh in on whether you'd like a we're done with child's murder t-shirt, please? And also whether Redbubble are evil. we could do merch. We could. Anyway.
Someone would have to design them, though.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I do actually have a few other things that someone else messaged or sent some messages on Twitter about, which is the duster or the fly whisk that the Lord Equal Dirt was using as a weapon.
Okay.
So we kind of said that was very weird as a weapon, but apparently it's a general thing to depict a like Taoist deities as using.
Okay.
It's kind of, I think it's meant to be like a symbol, like a symbol of compassion, to use this kind of, like, it's kind of like a duster type thing as a fly whisk to kind of bat flies away without killing them.
Huh. Interesting. That completely changes the context.
It's kind of important to have cultural context around things sometimes.
Yeah.
So that we don't make arses of ourselves. And the other thing was apparently that 100 Flower Shame is meant to be a compliment. In that she's...
Well, that very much can... Yes. Oh, God.
In that, like, she's so beautiful that she puts the flowers themselves to shame.
Okay. That definitely does change. Her family are still dicks. I would like to be very clear on that, but that does change the con. I have been rather racist, haven't I? Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how to deal with kind of criticizing the book too. I don't want to completely.
See, I would love to delve more into the cultural context, but you know the format is that I'm supposed to be surprised, and I do enjoy acting the clown on here. So we'll have to discuss a way to deal with this going forward, but in the meantime, obviously our podcast format is not more important than, you know, honoring the history of an entire fucking demographic, which is often mutilated, appropriated, and misheard. I am, however, really, really glad that we have the kind of audience who calls us out on that, and who also, like, picks up on smaller details as well, which is really, really cool.
I don't know what the best way to kind of handle any kind of criticism that we have of the narrative is. I'm generally kind of, I would usually be hesitant with kind of media in general to attribute any all kind of blame to a singular author figure, but then with this kind of thing, I don't want to, like, I would prefer in general to kind of talk about the culture around a story, but in this case I'm very ignorant of the culture around this story, to be quite honest, and so I don't want to just go say read something and then immediately just brush it off as, oh, well, you know, that might seem bad, but China at the time, whatever. I don't know anything about China at the time. I don't, to be honest. So I don't want to, I don't want to just kind of say anything is of the time or of a particular author, or I, you know, when we don't really know one way or the other.
Yeah.
To put it no, in that context.
We should definitely meet to discuss a way around this because, you know, we need to do better. And we'll have a think on it, but I'm really glad that A, people pull us up on those details because it's important, and B, people notice those details because people who notice those kind of details are my favorite kind of people. So that's good. Anyway, we're done with child murder. Did you hear?
Yeah, so the pilgrims are on the road again. They leave the precious Image Elephant Kingdom behind, and they just carry on the pilgrimage until one day they come to a tall mountain, and Tripitak is a bit worried that there might be tigers or wolves about, but Wukong says not to worry. You know, he can deal with anything. And they come across a man chopping firewood, and he tells them that there's vicious demons and cruel monsters on this mountain and who want to eat travelers heading west. So Tripitaka starts shaking in fright, but Wukong tells him to relax and steps forward to question the woodcutter himself. So the man tries to warn him about how dangerous these demons are, but Wukong obviously isn't worried. He doesn't give a shit, as normal. And the woodcutter calls him mad and says there's two demons here who live on the mountain, which is called the Level Top Mountain, and they live in the Lotus Flower Cave, and they're waiting for a group of pilgrims from the Tong Empire to pass through. They have their names and portraits drawn up to identify them, and they plan to eat them.
That is a coordinated banquet.
Yeah, so Wukong is like, oh yeah, that's us. The woodcutter's like, yeah, well, they specifically want to eat you. And Wukong's like, oh, lucky us. How do they want to eat us?
Did they mention seasonings? You know, are there marinades going to be involved? You know, are there spices I can loot on the way out after I leave these people in pieces? What's the correct vegetables?
Well, so what he's concerned with is if they want to eat me head first, well, that's fine, but if they want to eat me feet first, that's more bothersome. And the woodcutter asks, what's the difference between eating you head first and feet first? Wukong explains. He says, you know, you don't have any experience in this kind of thing, but if he eats me head first, you know, he'll kill me one bite, and that's fine. But if he eats me feet first, he could eat us all the way up my shanks, my thighs. He could get all the way up to my pelvis, and I still might not be dead. That's much more bothersome.
And this is why you should always jump head first into the jaws of death.
So the woodcutter says back, Monk, he's not going to spend all that effort on you. All he wants to do is catch you and throw you in a large steamer. And once you're cooked, he'll just eat you whole. Wukong says, oh, that's even better. There won't be any pain at all in that. I just have to endure a bit of stuffiness first.
I feel like being steamed to death would be painful.
I mean, he survived...
He was in the brazier.
Oh, I'm never going to live that down.
No, you will not.
So the woodcutter says not to be so sassy. These monsters are pretty dangerous. They have five powerful magical treasures. If you want to protect this priest of yours, you'll have to become a bit mad.
A bit mad.
The next few lines are kind of a weird back and forth. It might be like a saying that is more common or makes more sense in the original language, but Wukong asks, how many times will I have to become mad? And the woodcutter says back, at least three or four. And Wukong says, oh, that's nothing. We must go mad 700 or 800 times a year.
I mean, that's my average.
So Wukong leaves the woodcutter and he returns to the others to tell them that there's no big deal, it's just some monsters to deal with. And so they start to head off, but Tripitaka says back to him, so why did that woodcutter just disappear into thin air?
Yeah, it sort of seems like that was almost a like a the password to Swordfish sort of situation where they're speaking in code and it's like, ah, I know you. You also had a secret drinking game in fucking the Jade Emperor's closet or whatever the fuck.
Yeah, so it's not a code, but Wukong flies off to investigate and see where the woodcutter went, and he sees the Day Sentinel, which is one of the deities sent by Guanyin to look after Tripitaka in secret,
Ah.
at the edge of the clouds. And Wukong gets pissed at him, and he asks why he tried to trick them and disguise himself instead of just giving them a plain warning.
Yeah, this does seem like that this is the equivalent of like a meeting that could be an email.
Well, yet why are you like pretending to be a random hermit instead of just telling us?
Like you've got you can just go, yo, don't go there, you're gonna be eaten. They may or may not have cool spices, but don't.
So the Sentinel is a bit frightened by Wukong. He bows and he apologizes, but he does repeat that the monsters really are actually pretty dangerous and you should be careful.
He just wanted to be a woodcutter. This is God drag. It's like.
They just do this a lot. They prefer to always give their warnings as this kind of in disguise rather than plainly. Wukong heads back to the group, but he does wonder what he should do. The Day Sentinel did seem to think these monsters were really dangerous, but he's worried that if he tells Tripitaka that, Tripitaka will just kind of have a meltdown. He doesn't think of Tripitaka's ability to deal with stress very highly.
I mean, the man keeps falling off his horse.
Yeah,
He's a
so
mess.
he considers just telling him it's fine and leading the way as if nothing's wrong. But then worries that if, trip something actually does happen, he'll have to go through all the effort of rescuing Tripitaka again. So he eventually decides to just send Baji to deal with them instead. So if Baji wins, great.
If he doesn't, well, that's too bad, isn't it? Oh well.
Yeah, well, Wu Jing doesn't like plan to let him die, but he thinks, if Baji needs to be rescued, that'll make Wukong look good anyway. He does think Baji is very lazy, so he's not exactly going to volunteer. So he comes up with a plan to trick him.
Okay.
So Wukong rubs his eyes a bit to get some crocodile tears going, and pretends to be very distraught when he returns to the others.
That's weird. I've always like I had headcanoned him was able to cry on command, but okay.
When Baji sees that Wukong is frightened by something, he suggests immediately abandoning the pilgrimage then and there. Just, if Wukong is worried about something, just fuck it. We're done.
Yeah. I mean, that is the smart move. If the insanely arrogant murder monkey goes and says, you know, guys, I think this might be a bit too tough, like that's. You go, okay, you know, that's fair. That's good input. We'll leave it.
So Tripitaka scolds Baji before asking Wukong what's wrong, and Wukong tells them about the Day Sentinel's warning, and he pretends to be scared of the demons and says he can't do it alone. So Tripitaka volunteers Baji and Wujing and gives Wukong permission to command them however he wants, which is exactly what he wanted to hear. So Wukong says he needs Baji to do one of two things. He either needs to stay here and look after Tripitaka, or else he needs to go patrol the mountain and try to find out about the demons, whichever he prefers. So looking after Tripitaka means attending to anything he needs. If he needs to move his bowels, you need to wait on him. If he needs food, you need to go beg for food for him. If he wants to go anywhere, you have to go with him. If he goes hungry at all, you'll be beaten. If he pales any bit, you'll be beaten. If he loses any weight, you'll be beaten. Or else you can go patrol the mountain and just find out how many monsters there are and where they live. That's all.
Okay.
So Baji likes the sound of the second option a lot better.
Is Tripitaka really that bad at looking after himself? Really? And it was believable. Yeah.
I don't know, he doesn't ever seem to actually do much himself at all.
Yeah. Fair, fair, fair.
So yeah, Baji likes the sound of the second option better, so he hitches up his clothes and he heads off straight away. So Wukong starts laughing at him behind his back as he leaves, and Tripitaka gives out to him. He calls him an impudent he calls him an impudent ape, and he says, "You haven't shown the least bit of sympathy or kindness as a brother. You're constantly envious of each other. You trick him into doing your work and then mock him behind his back." So Wukong says he's not mocking him. He just knows that Baji isn't actually going to do shit. He's going to find somewhere to hide for a while, and he's going to come back with a story he made up instead.
It's not mocking if it's really true and most likely the most likely thing that's going to happen.
So Tripitaka says, "How do you know that?" And Wukong says, "Well, I suspect it. Let me go follow him and find out. If he actually finds monsters, I can help him fight them." And Tripitaka says, "Fine, fine, fine, but just don't play any tricks on him." So Wukong turns into a mole cricket, and he flies off after Baji in secret, and he hides in the bristles behind Baji's ear. As predicted, after walking for 7 or 8 miles, Baji stops, drops his rake, turns back in the direction he came, and starts shouting abuse at the other pilgrims while he thinks they can't hear him. He calls Tripitaka a doddering old priest, Wukong an unscrupulous banhorse plague, and he calls Wu Jing a sissy.
Oof. I mean, Tripitaka isn't that old. How old is he at this point? Meaning that he's the youngest among them by a factor of like centuries, right?
Yes.
Like he compared to the rest of them, he is a fetus. He is a little fetus monk.
Baji complains if there's monsters around, they should try to sneak by them rather than going to look for them. And he decides to lie down in a clump of grass and have a nap before he just heads back and makes up some story. So once he's asleep, Wukong turns into a woodpecker with a very, very sharp beak and stabs Baji straight in the snout.
Oof.
He wakes up with a start, bleeding, and sees the woodpecker that just stabbed him and starts shouting at it too. He thinks maybe the woodpecker mistook his snout for a rotting tree stump, that there might be worms inside to eat. So he tucks his snout into his chest to hide it before lying down to sleep again. But Wukong just does it again. He bites him in the ear. Baji realizes he's not going to get any sleep here, and he thinks maybe he's after disturbing the woodpecker's nest, and he decides to just move on. Once he's gone, Wukong almost collapses with laughter before turning back into a cricket and flying off to follow him again.
This is the Wukong energy I appreciate.
Just being an absolute prick to Baji.
Yeah. You can't say he doesn't deserve it.
True.
I like the troll. I like Wukong the troll.
Yeah, fair. So 4 or 5 miles further into the mountain, Baji stops at three large stones, and he starts talking to them, pretending they're Tripitaka, Wukong, and Wujing, and he practices the story he's going to tell them when he gets back.
Rehearsing. Good.
So he starts off a bit rambly. He says, "If they ask me what kind of mountain this is, I'll say it's molded of clay, made of mud, wrought of tin, forged by copper, steamed with flour, plastered with paper, and painted with a brush. If they claim I'm speaking nonsense, I'll say some more. I'll say that it's a rocky mountain. If they ask me what sort of cave it is, I'll say it's a rocky cave. If they ask me what kind of doors there are, I'll say they're sheet iron doors studded with nails. If they ask me how deep the cave inside is, I'll say there's three sections. If they persist in trying to learn everything, if they ask how many nails there are in the door, I'll just say that old hog is too preoccupied to remember the exact number. Oh, well, that's everything. I'll just go back and hoodwink that banhorse plague." So Wukong flies back to Tripitaka ahead of Baji, and Tripitaka asks him where Baji is, and he says, Oh, he's just making up some lies. He'll be here soon. To which Tripitaka's response is, he's an idiot. What sort of lies could he be making up?
Fair. It's a fair point.
He thinks Wukong is just trying to play another trick on him. So Wukong tells him the full story, including Baji going to sleep and being bitten by a woodpecker in the mm-hmm. passive voice. definitely was just a random woodpecker.
Yeah, a woodpecker was there, you know. They're about, you know.
And he relates all the lies and all the answers that Baji practiced to himself, so that Tripitaka knows them in advance.
Hmm.
So when Baji arrives back, Tripitaka asks him if there were any monsters. And he says yes, a whole bunch of them. They called me Grandfather Hog and prepared me some nice vegetarian food. And they said they'd put on a big parade for us to take us across the mountain. I'm guessing that bit's meant to be more sarcasm than actually lying, but it's not.
Yeah, I'm guessing that, yeah.
That's not explicitly said, but I think that has to be sarcasm.
It's got to be.
So Wukong asks him if he's describing a dream that he had after falling asleep on the grass. And Baji apparently completely lacks any kind of poker face and panics and says, how could he know about me sleeping? Wukong grabs him and asks him the exact questions Baji had practiced. What kind of mountain is this? A rocky mountain. What kind of cave? A rocky cave. What kind of doors? Sheet iron door studded with nails. How deep is the cave? There's three sections inside. And then Wukong stops him and he says, no need to say anything else. I remember the last part quite clearly. How many nails are there on the door? Just say that old Hog is too preoccupied to remember clearly. Isn't that about right? He also said, let me make up this story so I can go hoodwink that banhorse plague. Isn't that right?
Ooh.
Baji, knowing that he's been fully caught up, starts kowtowing down and he asks Wukong, did he follow him? And Wukong gives out to him and tells him to get ready for five strokes with the rod as punishment. And Baji says that's going to kill him. And Wukong says, well, if you're afraid of being beaten, why did you lie? Baji promises to never lie again. And Wukong says he'll go easy on him then. He'll just hit him three times instead. Baji begs for Tripitaka to intervene, and Tripitaka says that he didn't believe Wukong at first about Baji lying, but seeing as it's clearly true, you do deserve to be beaten, but we need everyone in good shape to cross this mountain. So he tells Wukong he can beat Baji once they've gotten clear of the mountain. He's very magnanimous.
Oh, but that's nice.
So Wukong sends Baji off again to patrol the mountain for real this time. And Wukong doesn't follow him, but Baji assumes he does, and he starts to think everything that he sees is Wukong transformed. So he sees a tiger running across the mountain path in front of him, and he shouts at it. And then later, a sudden gust of wind topples a dead tree near him, and he shouts at the tree as well.
There is a Wukong in your head.
He sees a crow flying around overhead, and he shouts at the crow, elder brother, aren't you ashamed of yourself? I told you I won't lie anymore. Are you trying to eavesdrop on me again? So while he's busy screaming at random things,
having arguments with crows.
Yeah, in the Lotus Flower Cave, the two demons who do actually exist, they're still around. They're called the Great King Goldenhorn and the Great King Silverhorn. And they're chatting, and Goldenhorn wants Silverhorn to go out on patrol. He's heard that the Tong Monk is due to arrive in this area soon, and anyone who eats his holy flesh will have his life immeasurably lengthened. So Silverhorn thinks this sounds great. If they do that, then they won't have to practice all this meditation and all the other shit they have to do to prolong their lives normally.
He wants a shortcut.
Basically, yeah. So Goldenhorn tells him to hold on a second. We don't want to just kill any random monks that wander through. There's no need to break the law necessarily. So he has some portraits of the monks drawn up, labeled with their names, and he gives them to Silverhorn to take with him so he can identify them.
Interesting.
Silverhorn takes the sketches and takes 30 fiends with him to go and keep an eye out for the monks. So they run into Baji on the road, who introduces himself as a simple traveler. He doesn't mention the pilgrimage at all, because that's been trouble for them before.
I mean, he learned something.
Yeah, but one of the fiends thinks he looks familiar and takes out the portrait and holds it up to compare them. And Baji sees that they have a drawing of him and he is very concerned. They spot Tripitaka, Wukong, and Wujing in the distance and match them to the other portraits that they have. So Silverhorn attacks Baji with his Sword of Seven Stars, but Baji is able to block him with his rake and they start to fight. They're fairly evenly matched, and Baji actually probably has the upper hand. Silverhorn isn't sure he can win, but he has all his little fiends with him, so he calls them for help, and seeing how outnumbered he is, Baji decides to turn and run, but he trips over some vines. As he's struggling to get up, competency, he was almost doing well for a minute.
I mean, I think we can, the vines were just there. Who among us has not?
So as he's struggling to get up, one of the fiends tackles his legs and he, I am quoting directly here, hit the ground head first like a dog eating shit.
Oof.
The rest of the imps swarm over him, grab him, hoist him up, and drag him back to the Lotus Flower Cave. And if you want to find out what happens to him, that's the next chapter.
Okay. Very cool. But I'm not sure what I want to happen to him, to be honest. He is Baji with all that entails.
Yeah, that's fair.
But yay!
I do find it funny. Wukong relates the whole story with Baji and the woodpecker twice in the chapter. Once to Tripitaka, and then he repeats it like to Baji that he saw it all as well. And both times he's just like, "And then you were woken up by a woodpecker."
Mysterious woodpecker.
He's completely open to admitting, I was following you and spying on you, but he's kind of keeping that little detail to himself.
And I think he's just doing it for fun. I think it's just giving him a warm, fuzzy feeling inside.
Well, I think he's trying to skirt the line as well, that like he knows he can kind of convince Tripitaka that this was justified by if Baji was lying, but Tripitaka did like specifically warn him not to fuck with Baji, so he's not going to admit to intentionally hurting him and fucking with him more than he needed to.
This is true, but I also think he just derives plenty of satisfaction by going, woodpecker. Yes.
The woodpecker. The mysterious woodpecker that had nothing to do with me.
I've got news. It was I! I was the woodpecker! He's building up for a big reveal. He's just going to drop little hints here and there, and then, you know, it's just kind of, will the woodpecker come and save us? Ha-ha! I was the woodpecker! And no? I don't know where this is going.
I don't think he's ever going to admit to this.
Okay, well, this is where the fan fiction I'm writing in my head is going, Quiva.
Okay.
None of you will ever know my archive of our own username. Ever. Ever. But it's out there.
I do have a few other things I wanted to bring up.
Yes.
One of them is just the wallpaper lady's name was Lee Quilian.
Lee Quilian? Okay. Yay!
L-I, first name, or, well, surname actually, really, right? And forename, C-U-I-L-I-A-N.
Okay.
Is how it's romanized here, at least. The other thing was, did you see the, really androgynous, like, hot Sun Wukong art that I retweeted?
No! I've been taking regular Twitter breaks because it's Autism Acceptance Month and I'm on my last fucking nerve, but this I have to see.
I just sent you the link there.
Oh my god, okay. Oh yeah, it's in chat, I can see this. Oh my god. Now that is a handsome monkey king.
Yeah, this person's entire DeviantArt page is, or at least like half of it, is just like sexy Sun Wukong. They know what they like, and they are going for it.
No fucking judgment. I'm really loving the who's the artist? Chomart on DeviantArt has a really beautiful sort of, I don't know enough about digital art to know whether that's, I don't know what that is, or if it's sort of a watercolor-esque. It's like,
I think some of them are literally watercolors, because they mention if you open some of them in the description, they actually describe the camera that it was photographed on. So I think they're actually watercolors that are being photographed.
Oh, it's really beautiful. This person is very, very talented. But yeah, this is not the Sun Wukong I was picturing in my head. Certainly not. Follow this person. I am on my work account. I am not following this person. I'm unliking that tweet very quickly.
Oh no.
I will relike it from my other account. If you get the notification, McClan Jr. 81, please don't rot me out, okay? just be chill. Yeah, that is beautiful.
The other thing I wanted to bring up was slightly more serious. Which is, it's not directly related to Journey to the West in any way, but it does have to do with kind of, I guess, Western interactions with Chinese culture, and I think it's interesting. It's one of those things where you never think about how strange something is, because it's been completely ubiquitous for your entire life and you've never really thought about it.
Yeah.
But so I was recently reading Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal, which is just like a daily gag comic.
I love it.
Yeah, so there was one particular strip that was the idea of like a new religion or philosophy needing initial prophet and then would die and then have a posthumous evangelist, basically. And the line was, Jesus has Paul, Socrates has Plato, Confucius has Mencius. And I hadn't heard of Mencius before, and I thought immediately, well, that's odd. Mencius is very obviously not a Chinese name. Wait. Confucius is very obviously not a Chinese name. Why the fuck is he called Confucius? Which I'd never thought of before.
So this is obviously the anglicization or the Latinization.
So it's Latinization of Kong Fu Zi, which means Master Kong. Kong being his surname. His forename was Zhang Ni. So I think it's interesting though, because it's not just like a simple thing of, they decided the Chinese name needed to be changed because it was difficult. Because it's not just Latinized because it's weird or foreign or anything like that. It was the first writing about Confucius or Kong Zhangni came from Jesuit monks in China who were sending writing back to Europe in Latin. And it was normal when writing in Latin, and writing in all like philosophy works would have been written in Latin, and that to Latinize names, not like all names and not just foreign ones. It was the standard of the time for everyone, and that's kind of a standard of debatable value and has its own historical baggage. But like, if you take other examples like Nicholas Copernicus, as a fairly well of a scientist. Actually, maybe I'm misjudging how. No, do you know Nicholas Copernicus's name?
I know. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Philosopher's Stone, right?
No, he was a. Well, maybe actually, maybe he had some. Maybe he did investigations that as well. He was a. Astronomer.
Yeah, he was an alchemist. He was an astronomer, but he was also an alchemist.
Okay, actually, I didn't. So I know him from.
Or maybe I'm just like misremembering parts of Harry Potter. That's also possible. I don't know everything.
But so Nicholas Copernicus was a Pole. So his parents did not name him Nicholas Copernicus. They named him Mikolaj Kopernik, but when he wrote in Latin, he stylized his own name as Copernicus, and that's what he's known as internationally. And we know Isaac Newton as Isaac Newton. He was English and he had an English name and he was an English public figure. So his name is widely published and remembered in the English speaking world. But if you had a copy of
I know how to pronounce it, but I'm just gonna make you try.
Philosophiae Naturalis Principiae Mathematica. It does not say Isaac Newton on the cover. Do you want to guess what Isaac Newton's self-Latinized name was? What his Latin sona was?
No idea.
Isacco Newtono.
Ah.
Which is so lazy. He just stuck O's on the end of his name.
He wrote the damn book, you know. It's a big and complicated tome.
It's probably not like there was probably like specific standards. Anyone who was Isaac probably used the same Latin name. I don't know. I'm just making fun. Hey, I'm just popping in this extra bit post recording just to say that Isacco Newtono on the front cover of the Principia is specifically the dative form of that Latinized name, and the nominative form would just be Isaacus Newtonus. Similarly, or going the other direction rather, Nicholas Copernicus in the dative form is Nicolai Copernicato. Latin is a complicated language,
but you know it's kind of an done thing of the way these history works and how these figures became known in certain places, that we call Copernicus, or maybe we should not. Maybe we should call him Copernic.
Yeah, I think with Copernicus. Yeah, with Copernicus, that it's a really interesting thing, but if you're publishing under a different name and you have chosen this name.
Yeah.
I think that's different, even if you maybe did it under the pressures of, you know...
Those were the publishing standards within Europe at the time, basically.
Yeah.
You wrote in Latin and you made a Latin version of your name for that writing.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like There's a whole question around that about whether it was something imposed on you, or whether it was something you chose. Now, when it comes to publishing and getting things published, and this is a debate that we had with, you know, putting quote-unquote real names of women authors that had written under male pen names on their work. There were some really interesting, also some gender related questions about that. Of course it got ridiculous and weird and overblown, and everyone hated us and everyone on the internet, all bigots on the internet were screaming. But there was some interesting points there about even outside the gender stuff, about identity and how you build a different identity for your work. But I think if it's something from, like, we've looked at another culture and we've just imposed the Latinization of the name on that culture without consulting anyone in the process.
Yeah, that is certainly not the exact same thing.
I think there's
probably not like any good justification for continuing to use the name Confucius other than what he is known as.
So big question mark over Copernicus, because even though, you know, possibly I don't know a lot about the cultural context of that time. I imagine that having a Slavic name may have been, or a Polish name even, may have been a disadvantage, and that, you know, this was publishing standard across all of Europe, and it very much came from, yeah, but the fact that he chose Copernicus himself makes things a lot more murky, you know. I don't know. It's a very interesting thing to think about and discuss, but I don't think there's any excuse for it when it comes to like continuing to use Confucius. I don't know. Please weigh in on that if you would like to. I know we have very interesting nerds listening to this, and I love them very much.
Yeah, two random people on a podcast who know nothing about what they're talking about at all aren't going to really be the people to solve this either.
Yeah, but it's fun to talk about. Anyway.
Because
I don't know, it's very, very different, and the circumstances under which I made this sort of artistic work, normal work, personal life split with my name were obviously very different. But MJ Stokes is a very who goes on stage and who does podcasts and who hangs out with their friends is a very different person than Morgan Stokes, who goes to work and gets shit done and, you know, goes and sees their family. And it's yeah, it's an interesting thing to think about anyway.
Yeah, but
not to center myself in a discussion that was in the beginning about imposing Western lenses on philosophies that do not lend themselves to that, including then, you know, appropriating the name and making that the standard, which is, you know, kind of not cool.
So yeah, his actual name was Kong Zhongli, and Mencius was Mengzi, and I'm sure I'm also like saying those wrong as with everything else, because Chinese, even listening to examples, Chinese pronunciation is very different to European pronunciation, and
tonality in language is a thing. We don't even speak our own language correctly.
Oh no, we don't
anymore.
No.
Well, I mean, if there's a whole question around that as well, as like, can any language be spoken correctly if it is a living language and you're using it to communicate, etc., etc. But one of the ways Irish is taught in a lot of words in Irish, and there's an extra I at the end before the end consonant, and that pluralizes it. But the way it's taught in schools, if you don't grow up speaking it, people, native English speaking teachers often don't make a pronunciation.
There's a concept of a broad and a slender consonant.
Yeah, yeah.
And a broad and slender consonant are pronounced differently. And I literally only discovered this when I was 30, even though I went through many years of schooling.
Yeah, same. And with being a little bit of a word nerd as well. But it for any international listeners, in the same way that in Russia, I might be mangling this, ugol means corner and ugol means coal. Or the other way around, I don't know. My Russian is fucking awful. Lower in Irish means a book, and lower means books.
Yeah.
But and it's just a different, slightly different way you move your mouth, but nobody ever taught us that. It was just lower and lower. I'm like, okay.
Decade and a half in school, didn't know that you were actually meant to say the plural and singular of those words differently.
Yes, and somehow, it's a fucking headache. How did we get on to this? I don't know.
I was saying that I was very bad at pronouncing Chinese words and names.
I don't know.
And the concept of us not being able to really handle tonality as being part of the pronunciation and the meaning of a word, which it isn't in Chinese and not in European languages, and that makes it very difficult for us to hear the distinctions. And then it's similar in Irish. There's the distinction between the broad and slender consonants that don't exist in English, and so it's hard for native English speakers to hear and internalize that, and Irish teachers often don't either.
I mean, collectively as monolingual English speakers, we do need to get our heads out of our asses and just embrace the wonderful world of tonality, but we're not going to get it perfect on everyone. We can try.
I apologize to anyone who has listened to this podcast who like actually knows Chinese and has to like is pulling their ears off every time I say anything.
Oh God. Do you think it's like when Americans just mangle Irish place names?
Oh, definitely. I am definitely that tourist on this podcast every day saying yogel.
Yogel. Oh, in fairness, y'all is a difficult one. Anyway, we should probably leave it there.
Yeah, we've successfully made everything about all the cultural issues with dealing with Chinese literature and the Chinese language all about us and Ireland. So
we did, because we're cunts like that. But we will. We're going to have to sit down and develop a plan that allows us to both honor the cultural context of the novel and preserve the kind of loose nature of the podcast.
Probably not right now, though, as I've already kept MJ over time.
Goodbye! Social media details in show notes.
Hunting Pod.
Bye. Yeah.